Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, September 25th, day 8 of our fall membership campaign. Today we check in on Hawaii's timeshare scene as tourism numbers are down. Are timeshares bucking trends or not? Where timeshare numbers are down and where they are up. Plus, we hear from a researcher who's taking a closer look at breakthroughs in mental health treatment through psychedelics. Who benefits? Who doesn't? What the numbers in Pacific Island communities tell us. And shell stories, memories of internment, sparked by a family's shell collection. We learn from an author about the first children's book to tackle the history of Hawaii's World War II incarceration camps. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This week, tourism officials heard about the timeshare landscape in Hawaii. The Hawaii Tourism Conference wrapped up, and the numbers for visitors are down. The most recent data from July shows a nearly 5% decrease in visitors and visitor spending from the same time last year. The largest decline of 11% came from Canadian tourists. Timeshares also slipped slightly this last quarter compared to the same time last year across the state, with the exception of Kauai. Overall, it dipped less than 1%. This morning, we hear from Jason Gammel. He's with ARDA, the American Resort Development Association. The most recent ARDA report points to the generation of more than $518 million in our state coffers. And when we talked to Gammel last year, the timeshare business was bucking the trends. It led our tourism recovery out of the pandemic. What was interesting to hear back then is that the majority of its timeshare owners, now 57%, are millennials and Gen Zers, not baby boomers. Many grew up with vacationing in timeshares and have inherited their parents' timeshare properties. And Gammel says two-thirds of new timeshare owners are from that same demographic, younger. He says the timeshare landscape is still strong overall, but did take hits with our neighbors in Canada and Japan. Here's Gammel.
If you look over the last 15 years, you've seen a significant increase in the number of timeshare units that have come online and the number of timeshare resorts. So currently, there's a little over 100 timeshare resorts in the state of Hawaii. And if you look, they're all over the islands, Maui leading the way, Kauai second, then Oahu. And you look at the growth, which continues. We've got new development here with the Hilton Grand Vacations Kings Village. You've got also an opening last year when I was here, which was fantastic, of the Marriott Waikiki Beach. That resort has been very successful, always over 90% occupancy year-round, which is great to see. And you look at hotels, and the hotels have been a little bit more, I'd say, on pace. They've stayed relatively the same over the years. You've had a lot of refurbishments, some that have been knocked down. Hotel growth has been a little stagnant, but it doesn't mean it's any less important. As a matter of fact, the hotel growth usually is tied to more of group travel. So if you look at the group travel that comes with hotel, you look at the leisure travel that's almost exclusively for timeshare. That's why it's a little bit more, we'll say, resistant than other forms of travel, because it's not based necessarily on companies and how they might spend or conventions coming to Hawaii. Hawaii continues to be, in a timeshare traveler's mind, the number one aspirational destination we have. So people, in all circumstances, there's a reason to come to Hawaii. If somebody else isn't using it, they'll exchange. If someone's using their own, they want to exchange, and that's fantastic when people come here themselves.
We have always looked to timeshares leading the way with the recovery from the pandemic. Politics being politics, we've had some pushback from Canadian tourists and our snowbirds. We always welcome them over because many of them are timeshare owners. But what can you tell us from the view on your side?
It's unfortunate. Generally, I get to come in here and say that timeshare bucks the trend. Hey, for international travels, for instance, the international traveler, we have seen an increase, and some of our members are reporting anywhere between a 15 and 30% increase year over year in international travel generally. That's great to see. However, the Canadian tourist is the one area where there have been fewer arrivals to Hawaii, and that's across the United States. The nice part about it for some of our members who have properties in Canada, they have seen a significant increase to those properties in Canada. So you see the Canadian tourists staying home.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's a positive for some of those resorts, but overall for us here in the United States, whether it's the mainland or here in Hawaii, it's unfortunate, but there has been a decrease in that traveler coming from Canada. I think that's just the general macro trend that we're seeing across the board, whether it's people who are traveling across the border to go to places like New York or Maine, places where they've traveled or done day trips or weekend trips. Those trips have been down, and it's double digit in airfare. When you see across the United States an increase in over 10% of the number of Canadians that are coming in, the flights from Canada coming to the United States. And that trend still seems to be consistent.
Yeah, so we're getting the cold shoulder from Canadians because they're insulted by something our president said, and they don't like the idea of being the 51st state. And so they're staying away. Are the numbers dropping as far as new timeshare sales with our Canadian friends?
So for our Canadian friends specifically, since they're not here as much, yeah, they'll probably let sales. Overall, sales have continued to be steady. As a matter of fact, we've had year-over-year increases from quarter two to quarter two in 2024 to 2025. We've seen about a 4% increase in overall sales, which is good to see. The travelers are still traveling. People are still loving their product. And travelers from different areas and maybe different parts of the world are still finding timeshare a great way to travel. I think a lot of them are getting exposed internationally to new brands, and they're seeing the value. And once they're owners, they're now in the system looking to either exchange, buy more. And that seems to be the case for even when we were coming out of the pandemic. Revenge travel was happening during the pandemic for us. People were buying timeshare in 2020 and 2021 at a shocking rate, quite frankly, given the state of travel. But people were committed to traveling, and they wanted to show it.
There were also, though, a lot of foreclosures, a lot of folks from Japan, if I recall. Because I'd be looking in the public noticings in the paper, and yeah, that was sad because they weren't traveling.
It is sad. Yeah, and maybe they saw it as a little bit more of an impediment, that they didn't know when they were going to be able to actually get back on a plane or when it was going to be safe. That, fortunately for us, was a bit short-lived. And people were right back. And I think that has been the case, especially if we go back even back into 2008, 2009, great economic recession, you did see people that bucked the trend again. They may have been giving up on their home mortgage before they gave up on their timeshare mortgage. And that is something that's difficult to believe, but again, it just shows that commitment to vacationing.
And then even the yen, you think that there's some recovery there?
Well, right now we see the dollar starting to weaken a little bit. That makes a big difference, though. It absolutely does. When the yen is stronger against the dollar, then that purchasing power goes a long way. It's common sense there that you'll get more people traveling, especially from Japan to Hawaii in those circumstances. If the yen is weak, I think we all see that traveler from Japan stay home.
And is there any forecast as to when you might think we'll get a thaw with the Canadians or see any rebound there?
I think we continue to remain hopeful. From an overall perspective, it's so important in the United States for us to present the right message to our international partners. And that message is that we're fully open for business, that we want them to be here. We care about the international traveler, and maybe ancillary, we'd like them to come here and spend their money here in the United States. All the policies have to line up that way. And you've got some great organizations like the U.S. Travel Organization, who is advocating out there for things such as better visa processing, better processing at airports for people who are coming in from overseas, the $250 fee that Congress is talking about for certain. Those send messages to people that we're unwelcoming, that we're looking either to make money or that perhaps their dollars aren't as important as they were in the past. It's so important, though, that the organizations that are out there continuing to promote travel across the world promote that message that we care and that people feel that way. If that's the case, let's hope in the first quarter of next year we start seeing more people. That's the first opportunity, right, when it's in the middle of winter in Canada. Let's see if those travelers come back to Florida or Hawaii, where they like to come to warm weather destinations during those months. I think that's when we're going to see whether or not the policies are making a difference.
And you said that you had talked to the Hawaii Tourism Authority officials this week. Anything else that you want to underscore?
What's really important for us globally, we like to see the way that Hawaii is really looking at understanding their place in tourism and understanding that things might be slipping a little bit today. And this is an opportunity for Hawaii to rebrand, to emphasize what makes Hawaii special. And I think that was so much positive energy at the HTA conference, was listening to innovative ways for people to think about bringing people here through sports, through culture, through emphasis on all of the things that Hawaii has to offer. Same reason why a couple years ago when I brought my family here, they so appreciated doing all the cultural activities. They liked being embedded, ingrained somewhat in the culture and understanding what makes Hawaii special. Leaning into it is so big, and I think that's really important, and that was a big theme throughout the HTA conference, and people I spoke with seemed to really echo that. They thought there was a lot of positivity and hope for the future. It's going to take hard work and effort, and it's going to take a lot of people thinking about creative ways to bring people to Hawaii when there are other destinations and other options for people, especially in difficult, we'll say, global economic and geopolitical times.
And I don't know, does HTA give the timeshare folks any money to, or do they promote? I just don't know.
No, that's a great question, because really the timeshare industry has always done its own promotion, and we continue to be self-promoters. We very much appreciate the fact that they provide us a platform to talk about the timeshare industry and recognize the importance of the timeshare industry in Hawaii. And really what's nice, this is about the 20th year I've been coming to Hawaii, and each and every year goes by, you see a little greater acknowledgement and appreciation for the consistent visitor, for that prepaid vacation, for people who are coming here knowing that they've already paid for their accommodations, or they know how much it's going to be, so they come here looking to spend money on activities, artwork, you name it. They want to spend their money here. And that's good. And I think that's a positive thing for us. We may not take any dollars directly, but we do benefit from the overall tourism promotion and things that HTA does. And we do promote, we help when people come here, they do stay in timeshares for all the different promotions that come from HTA. And we're hopeful that in the future, we'll continue to see that growth. And well, as they say, hopefully the rising tide lifts all boats.
And then real quick, so then as far as the opening of new properties, then what do you see coming online next across the state?
Yeah, so we just had the Maui Bay Villas that reopened after a time of renovation. So that's great to see the units there in Maui. We also have a Hilton property that we talked a little bit about earlier, King's Village. Yeah, that's one that's under construction. And the Marriott, which just opened last year, that's fantastic. We'll start seeing, and hopefully next time we have this conversation, we'll talk about another shovel or two on the ground. We'll hope that always is an opportunity here, especially in Waikiki, as there's always constant redevelopment in the area. And I think that's where you'll see more timeshare growth.
That was Jason Gammel, CEO of the American Resort Development Association, with a snapshot on the timeshare landscape across the state.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters La Piha Makahiki, a 100% ka'u blend with notes of strawberry jam, brown sugar, and sweet lime at BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com or at their cafe in Hilo.
We have been hearing more and more about the use of psychedelics as treatment for mental health issues. And there's a study published this month that looks at health disparities. Specifically, a scientist argues that data on psychedelics may be skewed without diverse clinical trials. We recently talked to Sean Vigna, assistant professor of sociology at the University of the Incarnate Word. It's the largest Catholic university in Texas, and his research specifically looks at psychedelic use among Asians and Native Hawaiians.
If you pay attention to anything when it comes to psychedelics today, it's really coming from a clinical standpoint, and there are very few people who are looking at it from a cultural or epidemiological standpoint. So there's only a handful of us. So as I've been studying this aspect, and really this small group of us have really pointed out some huge gaps in this kind of clinical side. As we're looking at these variations, one of the variations that popped up over and over again is the difference between whites with Native Hawaiian or Pacific Islanders and Asians. And so there's some very interesting variation there. And as somebody who used to live in Hawaii, I've been drawing on some of my own personal experiences, but a lot of the research to try to understand and explain these differences. Hawaii is just very unique in its culture, in its, again, its structure, the universal healthcare. I mean, everything about it is very unique, and it seems to be affecting these different patterns for these couple groups here.
Share with our listeners why you decided to look at this field of psychedelics and mental health care.
Honestly, when I first got into looking at this field, or starting to do the research that I went into was from a naive perspective of, I had seen what the research was. It's very promising. If the psychedelics are doing some incredible things when it comes to these clinical trials, and some of the stories you hear about what's happening when it comes to veterans and mental health. And, you know, I definitely had an interest in that. what I was interested in was to look at it from this sort of ethnic, racial, or cultural differences to see really the perspective, the theory that I had, and a lot of us had going in, is if psychedelics can help with mental health so much, clearly those individuals who have the worst health patterns should get the most benefit. And it's the absolute reverse. Marginalized people seem to be getting the least amount of benefits from psychedelics. And there's a lot of reasons why this is the case. But upon further analysis, we know that that's really the pattern consistently. Where new resources come out, they seem promising based off of clinical trials or some other research. And then marginalized people, whether race or ethnic or gender, don't seem to get the same benefits. And so that's where the research, this kind of has spiraled into, just to really identify all of these patterns of these different groups, which are not going to enjoy the same benefits. And so it's a very important picture to understand, because the narrative coming around psychedelics as being these kind of universal things, being extremely helpful. Some researchers going so far as to say, not researchers, but advocates saying that these things could, you know, end the mental health crisis, or even say stuff like it could bring around peace or change, right? All of those things are just not in line with what the empirical evidence says and what the long history of new interventions have shown, that they just don't do these things because of other social and cultural things.
We've heard more and more recently about the need to diversify the clinical trials. If you narrow it down and it's just one particular group, Caucasian, you know, male, whatever, that you leave out, let's say, women and minorities. And
right.
So, you know, we just recently had a settlement here in Hawaii with Plavix, with a big drug company, about, you know, how the drug was not working quite so well on Asians. And so this is just something I think that needs to be at the forefront as we consider, you know, what's being prescribed and who is it actually helping.
Right. And that's one of the most important things, and why I think people are getting a misunderstanding, is because the clinical trials, particularly in the psychedelics, is just a prime example, but it's across all clinical trials, are so incredibly underrepresented. We've had lots and lots of meta-analysis. Large studies have come out to analyze the clinical trials, and some of them are phase 3 trials. I'm talking about studies that are now, the next phase is to completely decriminalize or legalize these psychedelics. Some of those trials are 300 people that are 90% white guys, right? Stuff that's published in the New England Journal of Medicine or JAMA, poorly representative on women. And so there actually are rules. There actually are rules, which is that the CDC or the NIH had, about trying to force representation. And those rules have since not been enforced. It was actually a rule that was trying to do under the Biden administration, and those things have been scaled back among this current administration. And so, yes, they are completely unrepresentative. And with something like psychedelics, where is it the drug or is it the social? Anybody who's used any of these drugs, either a clinical or non-clinical standpoint, know that there's a lot of social things you get out of these drugs. If we have reduced it down to a population of 100 veterans and only focused in on PTSD related to combat related trauma, and also try to get rid of every other comorbidity, what do these clinical trials really show us when these drugs are so dependent on the social world that you are living in?
So you are just simply trying to highlight the inequities and maybe things we need to be mindful of as we explore the use of psychedelics and treatment.
So, absolutely. We absolutely need to be mindful. They're pushing legislation now, and Hawaii is one of those places. Hawaii recently passed a couple of bills to understand psychedelics. SB 104T, to create two pilot programs, and another bill that acknowledges clinical trials promise, B2630. And these are wonderful. I mean, we should be looking towards this because of what the evidence shows. But they're focused in on trials which are completely unrepresentative. There are trials right now that are in these phase 2 that Hawaii has passed their laws on that have no Asians in them and have no Hawaiians in them or any other Pacific Islanders. How can they even think that the clinical trial, or excuse me, a clinical model, you know, a therapy model, would be salient to these two populations when we have no evidence because no trials have ever been collected of these people. So it's really getting, what's the phrase, the putting the horse before the cart, or the cart before the horse?
Yeah.
Right? It's so far past it. At the same time, you have to understand that when it comes to these drugs, the way that the laws are being passed is it is criminalizing some of the cultural aspects. If somebody wants to use some of these drugs, say psilocybin mushrooms, and we know generally they are non-toxic, you almost cannot overdose from these things. They're even less toxic than even alcohol. The way the laws are being constructed, you will only be able to use it with a therapist in a clinical setting. If you want to go use this with your in a social or group-like setting, in a communal setting, the way these drugs have historically been used, if we look towards indigenous communities, that's illegal. You will be going to jail for that. So not only is it pushing one sort of frame, it's also making the other parts completely illegal.
That was Sean Vigneault, who is a social epidemiologist and whose research was just published this month. We will have a link to it on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. It started with a shell collection. When she was a child, Sharon Fujimoto Johnson inherited a set of old matchboxes. Inside were dozens of shells that her grandfather collected during World War II. He'd been incarcerated at Sand Island and Honouliuli internment camps, and family members say he never fully recovered from the traumatic experience. Some 2,000 Japanese Americans were incarcerated in Hawaii during the war. Fujimoto Johnson is the author and illustrator of Shell Song, the first children's book about the incarceration camps in Hawaii. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Fujimoto Johnson about telling her family story in a children's book.
When I was about 10 or 11, we were actually living in Japan at the time, and my father gave me his father's shell collection and told me it was shells that my grandfather had collected in incarceration camps during World War II. So, you know, I was pretty young, but I understood that these shells were precious and that shell collection traveled with me through the years. You know, I always wanted to be a writer. And, you know, I had also grown up hearing stories from my grandmother who told us all the stories about the years, you know, during the war and after the war. And my grandmother actually wrote a handwritten autobiography in Japanese and also a collection of probably about 50 tanka poems, also in Japanese, that I ended up translating in college. She entrusted her work to me. But I always wanted to figure out a way to tell this story myself. And it took me, you know, many years to figure out how to do it. And at one point, I just realized that it was the shells. You know, the shells carried my grandfather's story through the years and across generations. You know, he had died very young at age 49. His health had never been good after the incarceration camps. And so I had never had the chance to meet him or hear his story, but I had the shells that he had actually collected, you know, with his own hands. And so that was really the inspiration for my children's book, Shell Song.
Briefly tell us what the plot and the arc of Shell Song is. So what's this book about?
Yes. Many people are probably aware that on the West Coast of America, entire Japanese American communities were rounded up and sent to prison camps. Not as many people are aware that Hawaii had incarceration camps. On every island, there were places where Japanese Americans were held. So my grandfather was a U.S. citizen by birth, but because his father owned a trading company, Fujimoto Trading Company, in Hilo, that was the largest trading company at the time between Hawaii and Japan, my grandfather became a target of the FBI. So my great-grandfather, the owner of the company, was in Japan at the time that transportation was shut down after the attack on Pearl Harbor. So in his place, they decided to arrest my grandfather. So Shell Song is, in a sense, a very complex story. Like, it's a very large story of the incarceration camps here in Hawaii. It's actually the first children's book about the incarceration camps in Hawaii. It is, though, a children's book. So when I was making it, my thought was that it really needed to be centered on the shells. You know, shells are tangible objects that children understand and love. And also for me, that's where the story began, you know, when I was 10 years old, 10 or 11. I've described it this way, you know, the incarceration camp story is large and complex, but I didn't want to write a whole orchestra in this book. I wanted there to be a simple melody line, and that melody line is the shells. So in the book, my grandfather loves shells before the war. He collects more shells in the incarceration camps during those difficult years, and I imagine him thinking about his family that he left behind in Hilo and associating shells with, you know, his wife, his two children, and the baby that he had never met because the baby, my father, was born after he was taken away. And then I imagine him bringing those shells home and the shells being passed down through the generations. So that's kind of the story arc of Shell Song.
I think probably perspectives have changed, but I just think back to being a kid going to Hebrew school, and one of the field trips was to a Holocaust museum, and one of the students didn't go because her parents didn't approve her to go on that trip.
Oh.
What are your feelings on having difficult conversations about history with children, whether it's quote-unquote appropriate?
You know, interestingly enough, early on in the process, when I was just working on the manuscript, someone did ask me, why a World War II story for children? Like, isn't that a little bit heavy? And yes, it is a heavy topic, but I truly believe that children need to have access to stories that are outside of their own known experience. And in fact, right now in the world, for some children, war is their reality. And, you know, both for children who know these difficult things and children who don't, I feel like these books are so important. And ultimately, hopefully, having these windows into other worlds, you know, allows children to grow empathy for people who might be living life a different way or experiencing life differently from themselves.
We have been hearing from author and illustrator Sharon Fujimoto Johnson about her new children's book, Shell Song. Let's return to our conversation with Sharon Fujimoto Johnson. She's the author and illustrator of Shell Song. She spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender about some of the visual Easter eggs hidden in the children's book and a coincidental invitation that came shortly after the book was published.
I really want to talk about how you incorporated mixed media into your illustration, scans of the shell collection, and even... what would you even call this?
Like these are end papers.
End papers.
Yes.
Okay, describe what's going on in the end papers and maybe a few of the other really delightful Easter eggs that have so much meaning to you and your family.
Yeah, so on the end papers, I have some sketches of shells, but behind that, this golden yellow patterned color, and it's from actually the texture and color from my grandmother's wedding kimono. And that actually gets repeated early on in the wallpaper in their home scenes. And for me, it kind of represented the warmth and safety of home for my grandparents, especially prior to the war. And also on that page, there's the logo of Fujimoto Trading Company, my great-grandfather's company. I found that little matchbox cover on eBay, and so I obviously snatched it up quickly. My grandmother's clothing is actually constructed from fabric from her wedding kimono. And also, let's see here. Obviously, the actual shells, my grandfather's shell collection is in the artwork. And on the pages in the incarceration camps, there's soil from Honouliuli, and also Sand Island. Those were the two incarceration camps my grandfather was in. So thanks to the Japanese American National Museum, I had permission to have these soil samples photographed and was able to use them in my book. And it just added a layer of authenticity for me and meaning to have that soil in the artwork.
Yeah. I like your point about how it lends authenticity when thinking about the soil. But you shared that the day after this book was published, you were invited.
Yes. So it was just a serendipitous series of events that I happened to be invited by Honouliuli National Historic Site. Christine Ogura is the director. And she was trying to invite a group of descendants to join the meetings in which they were talking about the direction that this national park would go. Shelsong came out in April, and the day after I went to Honouliuli. So I had made this whole book without ever being in the places that this book came from. And so it was incredibly moving to actually be at Honouliuli. So in my grandmother's autobiography, she talks about taking the three little kids to visit and how they traveled on a red dirt road. And in fact, it's the same red dirt road that we traveled on. And I had my younger daughter, my 11-year-old, with me on that trip. And so we went down into Honouliuli, which is located in a very deep, isolated gulch between two mountains. And so when you go down into the gulch, you realize like how isolated it was. You can see a sliver of sky, but on either side, there are these mountainous walls. And so in fact, the Japanese American civilians nicknamed this place Jikokudani, which means Hell's Valley, because it was so hot and isolated, and there was lice and mosquitoes, and they were out in the elements. My grandmother, kind of wrote about all of this, but to be there myself, and it was very hot, but there are trees there now. The jungle has sort of taken back this land. And there was a breeze and there were trees, there was shade, I had a hat. But I imagined being there indefinitely, not knowing if or when you were ever going to get out, and having actually like no shelter and no trees. And it was really kind of a moment for me in which I really felt like I could feel what my grandfather, like the despair that he felt in those moments.
And to have your daughter there at the same age that you were first introduced to your grandfather's story. There's that moment of circularity.
Yes, very much a full circle moment and like a feeling of completion,
You're on island for a few events this week. Could you share with listeners what you'll be doing and, just ways if they want to learn more about Shelsong and your story? Ways to do that.
Yes. This Friday at Bishop Museum, I have an event from 5 to 8. And Bishop Museum is partnering with Honouliuli National Historic Site and Hawaii Malacology Society. And so at this event, there will be lots of activities for kids and families. The shell experts are bringing out the shell collection and the rare live snails. And also, families are invited to bring their own shell collections to hopefully have shells identified by the experts.
Oh, that's so fun.
Yes, and I will also be doing a live reading of Shelsong and talking about my family history and showing some photos. And I will have some children's activities as well. And then the following day, on Saturday, I have an event at Native Books. It's with local poet Richard Hamasaki and also another local poet, Ryan Oishi. And we'll be reading poems from The Gate of Memory, which is a poetry anthology of about 50 poets who are all descendants of incarcerated Japanese Americans and Japanese Canadians. And actually, currently, I have a museum exhibit at the Japanese American Museum of San Jose in California. And my grandfather's shell collection is there, along with a lot of family photographs and artifacts, my whole family story. And really, it's an exhibit that invites people to think about their own family heirloom stories and how to preserve and hopefully pass them on, because I guess one of my personal missions now is making sure that not only do I share these stories, but that I make space for the next generation to also feel like they can own a part of it and retell it themselves, because it really has to continue on, like beyond my generation.
It was such a pleasure talking to you this morning. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on your program.
That was author and illustrator Sharon Fujimoto Johnson. Her event at Bishop Museum takes place on Friday from 5 to 8 p.m. Look for links on our website later today. And that is it for our show. I'm Catherine Cruz.